There's a code of silence, and it can't go on.
Hi, folks. I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through the Matrix. This last while, I've been going into the techniques of control of the minds of most of humanity. I've gone into how the marketing engineers basically designed and gave us the culture, especially in the Western countries, mainly in the US, based on consumerism, and that Bernays, the nephew of Freud, is accredited with starting off this science in a big way, but he shouldn't be given so much acclamation because he wasn't the originator of propaganda by any means. It was being well studied in a previous century and many centuries before that too, at least in the 1800s. Various books came out on the behavior of the masses. And much of it was done by the Marxist groups who needed the masses to get their goals to come to fruition, to be achieved. I've also shown you how another group, a combination of groups really, they call them circles that are all intertwined, and you have to visualize them much like you see the Olympic flag. Circles triangulating with other circles, intersecting with other circles. And that's a system that has been planning the centuries. How old it is, you can trace it back for hundreds of years. I've been reading from Professor Carl Quigley, who gives you the beginnings of one part of it, another phase of it, I would say, starting with Cecil Rhodes, who supposedly was so enthused by the lectures he got at Oxford University by Dean Ruskin that he came up with the idea all on his own to create a British Empire system that became a nucleus of a world system. It spread the same culture and system across the whole planet. And ultimately, of course, the dream was to become a world government. This was taken up by Lord Alfred Milner and his group and the Round Table Societies. That's what I'm talking about. It's circles and circles. They also have inner circles, and very few people, even the higher members, are unaware who the top people are, and quickly admits that to himself. And they're still going at it yet. Every treaty we've got comes from the same groups. As Mr. Rockefeller always says, if you don't know history, you don't know what's happening. You won't know why. And it's quite correct, because what we get today is nothing but propaganda. Very carefully engineered propaganda, because we understand the workings of the human mind and how we come to conclusions. And therefore, really, under the many guises they go under, they could be called conclusion makers, because we come to their conclusions. This group, as I say, was involved in setting up the basis for a North American Union. They still are. They're the ones who draft up the agreements that are signed every year. The last one is to be signed in 2010 between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. They came out openly and declared such in 2005 on CBC Television Canada. And it's astonishing, in a sense, that the major media allowed them on to say their piece and just tell the public why we must integrate to compete with Europe. And yet here's the same group that was behind the unification of Europe beginning a long time ago. Because 100 years ago, that was one of their main objectives. If you tie it in with Karl Marx, who wrote about the trading blocks that would come in the future under world government, three regional trading blocks primarily. At least that's how it would end up, with a Far Eastern bloc, a complete European bloc, and also the American bloc under a world government. These are the same boys who have never changed their directions, never ever changed their directions as to where they've been going. That's something, again, that Quigley and others have mentioned, that foundations can hire and retire generations of people all employed on the same mandate. So it's not hard to see how they do it. What is difficult to understand is how some of the technocrats, the big players, can work their entire lives and never get fed up with it. They never put their feet up and say, I'm going to go fishing, Martha, and retire. The Kissingers, to the technocrats, the Kissingers, the Maurice Strongs, the Brzezinskis, all these characters are working and jet-setting across the planet, giving talks still on the same agenda. Same agenda. And they will claim it's for world peace, but then when you go into Carl Quigley's books, The Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, you'll see that this particular group has different branches of it, specializing in different areas, in their own records, because Quigley was a historian. He was allowed to get a hold of their records and update their history for them. In their own records, they admit that they were, in a way, involved in the setup of many of the wars that plagued the 20th century. They were all for Vietnam initially, and then later on they were against Vietnam, and that's the way they play the game. They were responsible for the setting up of the League of Nations, and when it had run its course, they then turned against it and demanded a new system called the United Nations. They set up the United Nations. In my talks, I've mentioned how the CIA and many of its members were also members of these same roundtable societies, Council on Foreign Relations, intertwined completely with the foundations that financed them. And that really, for at least, and probably longer, probably since the beginning of what we thought was democracy, we've never actually had it. Democracy is too fragile, they would claim, to be left to the people. But to remember, too, where the top members come from. They don't come from ordinary families or even middle-class families. They come from the ruling elite, the established elite. How long this established elite has been in existence is difficult to say. Did they set up in the 1700s an outfit that would eventually take over incredible financing to become the major bankers because their sons were all involved in these groups and worked tirelessly towards their ends? It's more than just a side play of politics. It's a method and a system to alter and shape all of society and eventually bring it into this new scientific age. Some will call it scientific socialism. And when you go into their old records, you find they're completely intertwined with this cry that we hear today. They've been shouting this for a long, long time, for well over 100 years, sustainability. And we have eugenics coupled with it as well. Now remember, Quigley had to be a member to get access to the records, and therefore he's also an apologist for them. He lets a lot out the bag in his books. His plates were, for the books actually were, bought over and then broken up, so they wouldn't keep republishing it. They didn't want so much of this out of the bag. But it was too late because others got a hold of it and copied it, and there's still original books circulating in libraries, unless they've been all recalled. Universities definitely have original copies. When you think of what they got up to, in the fact, to say, from the very beginning, their inception, at least as far back as Quigley goes, they were the ones that created the Boer War, this private group of people, a private foundation, basically, a society. And he calls it a secret society, and he said it was justly called that. It was very secretive. But they started the Boer War, which killed an awful lot of people. They got Britain involved in it by setting it up in such a way that the reporters they brought over with them would report lies back to the British government, so that Britain had to send troops out to what they thought was to protect the settlers who were being massacred. It was the other way around. The Cecil Rhodes Group hired a bunch of guys, and they attacked Jamestown and slaughtered a bunch of people. It was the other way around. And that's how they started off, this organization, by intrigue and deception. And then when you followed their history down through the years, they literally had a hand in all publishing. Now, we're so used to data being thrown at us, we don't inquire where it comes from, and very seldom do we ask what's the spin on it, what's the conclusion we're supposed to have at the end of it. It's admitted in Quigley's books that they had their hand in pretty well all of the academic books put out there, so that if you were getting history, you would get their version of history. And their version of history is always written in the same slant, that humankind is just too unstable, that it has to be mastered by an intellectual elite who must accept their mastery. That's what you're in, that's how you end up thinking. And when you go into many of their members and their circles, as I say, all intertwined, that were pushing socialism. Remember, Carl Quigley said himself that most people thought the communists were doing most of this work in the United States, all these far left movements. They didn't know that it was the Council on Foreign Relations that was behind it, funded by the big foundations. It appeared to be communistic to the outsider, all left, far left leaning tendencies. And they did the same in every country, including Britain. When you look at the founding people of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, like the Astor family, these are the same family with their foundation that was also funding the Fabian Society. You go into the founders of the Fabian Society and you have H.G. Wells, a propagandist again for this group. He was the one who coined the term in World War I to get young men enthused. Young men can be very idealistic when they think they're fighting for a just cause. And the slogan became, the war to end all wars. You couldn't get more idealistic than that. But Wells is also the man who dreamed up the idea, and Bernays would be very proud of him, and publicized it and got it through all the newspapers through the Royal Institute of International Affairs, or because of them, since they owned all the newspapers, that the young men who wouldn't join should be shamed into joining by their girlfriends and their fiancés, who would wear a white feather in their cap. That's good psychological warfare or manipulation. They understood propaganda perfectly well. And as I said before, Bernays himself could not have accompanied President Wilson around on the peace campaign to set up League of Nations, which was again in their own books here. The Anglo-American establishment was set up by the Royal Institute of International Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations. It couldn't have happened. He couldn't have got around to meet those high circles without being part of it himself. So propaganda was not a new thing at all. It's a science. These sciences are perfectly well understood. You wonder why Adolf Hitler held back at Dunkirk. You have to look into, again, the Anglo-American establishment, because the CFR and Royal Institute of International Affairs was writing a lot of the script for this whole thing. They'd met with the top German leaders before the war and given them lots of assurances. And Carl Quigley said here that they were behind allowing Germany to take Czechoslovakia as a pawn, basically. And then when you go into the double game they're always playing to achieve their ends, from the end of World War I to World War II, they were propping up Germany against the Soviet Union and hoped that one day they eventually might attack Russia, go eastwards, which is exactly what Hitler did. To understand the present, you have to understand the past, and you have to understand those who've helped pull the strings across the whole planet for an awful long time. It's hard for most people to put together bankers, charitable foundations, as they appear, and what appears to them as well as being semi-governmental organizations, but which are not governmental at all. They have many members within governments across the planet, but they're a private organization that have been manipulating the planet for an awful long time. And through conflict, they're trying to bring it all together. That's the old, old story of creating the Hegelian dialectic. How do you get people to merge? How do you get Europe to merge? And they discussed wars. Wars until people were sick of wars, until they'd just throw their hands up and say, please, save us from ourselves. Hopefully, that's the they always want the victim to think it's his fault. That's the best method of psychological warfare. And therefore, once you've had years of war and rationing, death and famine and all the rest of it, you can be guided along the plan that's been made long ago. Winston Churchill, as I say yesterday, I read a bit from this particular book, The Anglo-American Establishment, where he spoke about it in Parliament. He was not in at that time on the higher circles. He still had the same dream of a united Europe. And it's so amazing to hear the old recordings of Churchill's speeches. He started it, and Roosevelt started it, the US, their fireside chats to the people, you know, just cozy and just your next door neighbor talking to you. That was the whole PR part behind it. The propaganda works well. And then Churchill talked about uniting Europe, their age-old idea, to his peer group at night during their parties. This was recorded in The Fringes of Power. A book called Fringes of Power by his personal secretary, John Colville. I think it's now Sir John Colville, I think he got knighted. So here he is during the day making PATH news reels for the general public with good propaganda about going off to save your country, your way of life, and all the rest of it. While with his own peer group, he's talking about their age-old plan, our age-old plan. Who's we? Who's we? Because I think the people of Europe, the average person in Europe, never ever had dreamt of it. So who are we? Our age-old plan. But eventually he was brought in as prime minister to the higher workings, obviously. And he simply may have been peeved that a higher part of the circle had kept him out of the picture, because in 1946 in Zurich, Winston Churchill's speech was given to the academic youth. And it says, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored today by being received in your ancient university by the address which is given me on your behalf and which I greatly value. I wish to speak to you today about the tragedy of Europe, this noble continent comprising, on the whole, the fairest and most cultivated regions of the earth, enjoying a tempering, equitable climate, is the home of all the great parent races of the Western world. He goes on to say it's the fountain of Christian faith and Christian ethics and so on. It's very important at that time to use religion in your propaganda. He says it's the origin of most of the culture, the arts, the philosophy and science, both of ancient and modern time. If Europe were once united in the sharing of its common inheritance, there would be no limit to the happiness, to the prosperity and the glory which its 3 or 4 million people would enjoy. Yet it is from Europe that have sprung that series of frightful nationalistic quarrels originated by the Teutonic nations in their rise to power, which we have seen in this 20th century and even in our own lifetime wreck the peace and mar the prospects of all mankind. And what is the plight to which Europe has been reduced? Some of the smaller states have indeed made a good recovery, but over wide areas a vast quivering mass of tormented, hungry, careworn and bewildered human beings gape at the ruins of their cities and their homes, and scan the dark horizons for the approach of some new peril, tyranny, or terror. And he goes on to talk about, again, more tyranny, terror, and babbles of voices, and so on, which is getting to the point. The point is, of course, that now with the threat of the atom bomb, they couldn't have another war. That sounds very nice and idealistic. We don't want wars, do we? But then he goes on to talk about the unification of Europe as the only answer to it. Yet all the while there is a remedy which, if it were generally and spontaneously adopted by the great majority of people in many new lands, would, as if by a miracle, transform the whole scene and would in a few years make all Europe, or the greater part of it, as free and as happy as Switzerland is today. What is the sovereign remedy? It's to recreate the European family. To recreate the European family, or as much of it as we can, and to provide it with a structure under which it can dwell in peace and safety and freedom. We must build a kind of United States of Europe. Doesn't that sort of harken back to Marx again? And to Benjamin Franklin. Remember, Franklin was way into the revolutionary idea, of course, was a founding father. He's also the ambassador to France. He was the head, the Grand Master of the Nine Sisters Lodge. He initiated Voltaire into that lodge. And they were all about revolution, trying to find out why things that are happening in our lifetime actually happen, only to find out were planned long before we were born. And much intrigue and manipulation went into creating the wars. In fact, Carl Quigley mentions in the Anglo-American Establishment how the Milner Rhodes Society, the Royal Institute for International Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations, propped up Hitler right up to the war started. We all know that, again, the same characters who ran and owned the big foundations that were funding these particular groups also created IG Farben, which created the German war machine. You think of the length of time Adolf Hitler was in. It was only a few years from destitution to having a massive military machine. Where'd that come from? Read the trials and punishment of IG Farben, amongst other books. That's quite the trail. Because you'll find it's the same people that's been behind everything. And they're still at this world empire business today. And if it takes wars to get there, they'll have them. Getting back to this speech by Winston Churchill, he says we must build a kind of United States of Europe. In this way, only with hundreds of millions of toilers, or will they be able to regain the simple joys and hopes which make life worth living? The process is simple. All that is needed is the resolve of hundreds of millions of men and women to do right instead of wrong, and to gain as a reward blessing instead of cursing. Much work, ladies and gentlemen, has been done upon this task by the exertions of the Pan-European Union. This is the precursor they tried for, which owes much to Count Kuttenhof-Kalergi, and which was commanded by the services of the famous French patriot statesman Aristide Briand. He then goes on to talk about the League of Nations. He says, the League of Nations did not fail because of its principles or conceptions. It failed because these principles were deserted by those states who had brought it into being. And he's calling them states, you remember, not nations. It failed because the governments of those days feared to face the facts and act while time remained. This disaster must not be repeated. There is therefore much knowledge and material to which to build, and also bitter, dear, bought experience to stir the builders, because their builders love building bridges and things. I was very glad to read the newspapers 2 days ago that my friend President Truman had expressed his interest and sympathy with this great design and building. There is no reason why a regional organization of Europe, and they call it regions today under the United Nations, should in any way conflict with the world organization of the United Nations. On the contrary, I believe that the larger synthesis will only survive if it is founded upon coherent national groupings. There's already a natural grouping in the Western Hemisphere. We British have our own Commonwealth of Nations. Now going back to the Anglo-American Establishment, the League of Nations and eventually the United Nations were to be established on the British Commonwealth of Nations. And the term Commonwealth of Nations was termed, as Quigley said, by the Royal Institute for International Affairs, this private organization that works outside of democracy, although it uses their institutions since it pretty well dominates them. He says, these do not weaken, on the contrary, they strengthen the world organization. They are, in fact, its main support. And why should there not be a European group which would give a sense of enlarged patriotism and common citizenship, European citizenship, to the distracted peoples of this turbulent and mighty continent? And why should it not take its rightful place with other great groupings and help to share the onward destinies of men? help to shape the onward destinies of men, the grand design. That's my term. From theirs, of course, from other books. In order that this should be accomplished, there must be an act of faith in which millions of families speaking many languages must consciously take part. Then he goes into, they always use history to try, and again, this is explained in Carol Quigley's books, The Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope, how they'll always slant history to make it seem that we'll be moving towards a natural unification of the planet, and that all religions are working in some metaphysical way towards this amalgamation, and that all political processes are kind of evolving by themselves towards this same goal. So they spin their history to leave you again with a conclusion, which is a technique of propaganda. And as I say, these same people today are telling us that we must unite under a planetary system, because the new war is against, the new weapon really is man against the planet and the planet against man. The Gaia concept, as you say. It's quite something to really understand what's happening, because we live in propaganda pretty well all of the time. How far back do these groups go in societies? Well, you have to go back into the 1800s at least to get an idea, when they were doing a lot of writing about revolution, because it's to do really with revolution. And you must go into the writings of people like Robespierre and Voltaire, Bakunin and Trotsky, Lenin, all these people who talked about world systems, world societies, using the socialist front. Now, socialism is an interesting term, because it's like every other term that's used, from God to socialism, they get many different versions according to who you ask.
From myself, Alan Watt, it's good night to me, your God or your gods go with you.